Yeah, so thanks for the introduction and for all the talks that we've been seeing. Well, I'll be talking about this work that I did I've been developing over the last 2 years with José Luis Jaramillo and Lamis. So both are in France, in Bourgogne, and well, I was in Quimary when we started this. I'm currently visiting in Centra. Yeah, so these are the references from more of the mathematical background and some applications in gravitational wave theory. And well, the starting point in here is really black hole perturbation theory in its most basic setup. I mean, it's just the homogeneous equations that we want to solve. And here, think about Schwarzschild. Well, the potential can take into account scalar fields, as you know, electromagnetic or gravitational field, but essentially we can write down the wave equation in this way. It's a kind of canonical way of writing this down. And just to remind you that these coordinates are the traditional Schwarzschild coordinates, where t is just a Schwarzschild time and x is the tortoise coordinate. So they are here rescaled by the mass, but they are essentially just time and tortoise coordinates. And the typical behavior when you solve this equation with boundary conditions that I'm going to soon talk about is that, well, you see an evolution where you find some decay, an exponential decay with oscillations. So at the time scales, the frequencies, they are encoded in the quasi-normal modes. And there is also a late time and a tail phase. So, and the typical ways, so this shouldn't be here, right? I mean, I think this is, okay, this should be better for you. Yeah. So one typical way of studying this equation is to do the Fourier transform and go to the frequency domain. And in the end of the day, what you have is an ODE in X. And now I'm going to be a bit more specific about the boundary conditions. So when you go to X to minus infinity, we know that this is the horizon. What is the horizon? A very specific point. It's in this bifurcation sphere here. And when we go to X equals plus infinity along this Schwarzschild T constant, we are going to I naught to space like infinity. So here we have to tell about boundary conditions on to tell the field how to behave. I mean, if it has to behave here as a black hole horizon or as a white hole horizon. And here we have to see, well, the field should propagate out to the wave zone. I mean, formally to scry plus, or is some scattering problem where we have some ingoing coming from scry minus. So essentially we need to put the proper boundary conditions to pick up the black hole and to pick up the wave zone, to pick up the scry plus. So when we do this, I mean, our intuition goes and says, well, we have an operator acting on a function equals a value with function. We have the boundary condition. So, well, we know this is an eigenvalue problem. We have all our intuition coming from normal modes. And that's how we usually tend to start to tackle the problem. So let me review a bit of the mathematics behind these normal modes and normal operators. So first of all, think about matrices. And we know about, well, we have a matrix L. We have the adjoint L dagger. So we call this L normal if and only if L and L dagger commute with itself. And the example is if this is symmetric, Hermitian matrices in quantum mechanics, unitary matrices. And in this case, there is a very strong theorem called the spectral theorem, which says that, well, L is normal if and only if this is unitarily diagonalizable. Some side comment, well, we are talking about matrices, but this also goes to more complicated spaces like Hilbert spaces in quantum mechanics, or even fancier stuff like Banach spaces. But for us physicists, I mean, what matters here is that, well, whenever we're doing some physics with Hermitian operators, with self-adjoint operators, we can be sure, really, really sure through this theorem that the eigenvectors, they are orthogonal and they form a complete basis. And we can also be sure that the eigenvalues, they are stable. So if I perturb the operator just a tiny bit by a tiny epsilon, the eigenvalues will change also a tiny epsilon. Now, if we have a non-normal operator, if I cannot be sure that L and L dagger commute with itself, then talking about completeness is a bit way more difficult to study. The eigenvectors are no longer necessarily orthogonal. and we might face up some special probabilities. So we enter the realm of non-Hermitian physics, where we are dealing with non-self-adjoint operators. And so let's be a bit more specific in this case. So suppose we have your original operator L, and you are perturbing by a very tiny epsilon. So this perturbation is of order delta L is of order one in some norm, and you are putting some small parameter here. You can work out all the tools that we learned in quantum mechanics to see how the eigenvalue changes by this parameterization here. And what we see is that, well, it's bounded by the epsilon, but there is a number here called the eigenvalue conditioning number, which is this kappa number. And to build this kappa, we need the so-called right eigenvector, which is a eigenvector from the operator itself. And we need the left eigenvector, which is the eigenvector from the dagger operator. Well, Brian Ketch from quantum mechanics. And then again, we know about self-adjoint operators, meaning that L equals L dagger, then right and left are parallel, meaning that kappa equals one. So here's kind of the proof or explicitly seeing that if I have a small epsilon change in the operator, for sure my eigenvalues will change also a tiny epsilon. Now, so bottom line is small perturbation in the operator will lead to a small displacement in the eigenvalue. Now, what happens if we have a non-self-adjoint operator? We can no longer be really sure. We can no longer guarantee by the theorem that right and L are parallel. So if L and L dagger are not the same, they do not commute, then right and left may change and kappa can be bigger than one. And well, it can be really huge. It can be that right and left are actually orthogonal and kappa becomes really big. So bottom line is that a small perturbation in the operator may lead to potential large displacement in the eigenvalues. A second notion that we can look at is that, well, we've been talking about the spectra. So essentially we are solving eigenvalue problem. And an eigenvalue problem, we find the values in the complex plane where L minus lambda identity equals to zero. So this is essentially how we calculate eigenvalues all over. But you can ask yourself, if I'm slightly away from the spectra, this won't be zero, but well, it might be close to zero. So the pseudo spectra captures this notion that, well, if I move a bit away from the spectra, I will no longer get zero here, but I will go and find some epsilon. And then the question is, where is this region where this norm here is smaller than some epsilon? So the pseudo spectra captures this notion, and we can start with a self-adjoint operator. So the answer is, well, if you take a radius, a ball of radius epsilon around the eigenvalue, the pseudo spectra coincides with this ball. So conclusion, if I were to calculate the eigenvalue of the perturbed matrix, the eigenvalue would still be within the neighborhood of the original one. So those, this stability notion. Now, and here's an example. I mean, if you just consider a wave on a sphere, so there is periodic boundary conditions. The wave is just floating around the sphere. There is no dissipation. So the eigenvalues here are real. Essentially, these are related to the Legendre eigenvalues. And you see here this structure. So you see that kappa equals to one everywhere. So this was calculated numerically. And you see the pseudo spectra is there is are these circles of radius epsilon around the eigenvalues. Now, if we go for a non-self-adjoint operator, what happens is that this pseudo spectra, this notion here, doesn't coincide with this small ball here around the spectrum. It can extend really far away from this ball. So when you go and you calculate the eigenvalue of your perturbed operator, so even though this perturbation operator may be very small, the displacement in the eigenvalue may be huge. And so the takeaway message here is that, first of all, the unperturbed operator contains all pieces of information to assess potential spectral instabilities. And what I'm presenting here are some tools to measure this potential instability, which is the conditioning number and this pseudo spectrum. And so this has been around in physics. So there is this review from 2020 in archive and where they single out many, many scenarios where this happens. So Maxwell equations, We have Fokker-Planck equations, Newton equations, quantum trajectory, whatever, scattering theory, and well, enough sort of areas of physics. And we see that, well, gravity is not here. And essentially, well, in gravity, we do have a non-self-adjoint operator. So we have fields and have energy leaking away from the system. So we have the waves carrying away energy at far distance and also through the black hole horizon. And the main question that was missing here to include all this framework into gravity was like, okay, how can I capture geometrically this notion of the far distance and the black hole horizon? And the answer to this goes through going to the hyperboloidal slices, as well, there was some talks earlier today by Harris and Lydia that's showing some advantages of using these slices, and this is coming around from time to time. And so Bernd Schmidt was the first one to start pushing forward these. But then Zeng Noglu, over the last decades, was also pushing. And what essentially what Anil said was, well, black hole perturbation theory is typically studied on time surfaces that extend between the bifurcation sphere and spatial infinity. But from a physical point of view, however, it may be favorable to employ these time surfaces that goes between the future horizon and future null infinity. So this framework resolves many problems on the quasi null functions. What Jose Luis Jaramillo was also, when I was talking to him, and said, well, these compactified hyperboloidal approaches also allow us to cast black hole perturbation theory very neatly, very nice, in terms of this whole theory of spectral problems of a non-self-adjoint operator. So this is what happens when we go hyperboloidal, as I was mentioning before. Before, in this more traditional approach, we need to impose extra external boundary conditions to take into account the ingoing and outgoing boundary conditions. And now we are doing this geometrically by thinking about the foliation and the slices. And when you go to the PDE level at the differential equation, what happens is that these physical scenarios comes about when we look for the regular solutions of the equation. So there are some irregular terms that I'm going to show, and then you have to ask for, well, when is this equation leading to regular solution? So, and this is precisely the physical scenario that we are looking at. Okay, some results. Now, you will have to believe me that this is the Ridge-Wheeler equation, rewritten in all this hyperboloidal approach in the minimal gauge, as Lydia was mentioning. So essentially here, this red term is the hyperboloidal, the conformal Ridge-Wheeler potential. You see that there is no 1 over r. This is already out because of the geometric structure. There is no 1 minus 2m over r, because also this is already the horizon taken into account to geometrics. There is only this l plus 1 and all this term here with the spin. And in the blue part is the what I was saying, that it becomes 0. I mean, this principal part of the equation of the operator vanishes at sigma equals 0. And well, sigma equals 0 is scry, and it vanishes at sigma equals 1, and sigma equals 1 is the horizon. So this becomes irregular there, and we have to look at, well, when is this equation giving us regular solutions? And this gives rise to the quasi-null modes and another problem. But here we are interested not in the spectra itself, not in the quasi-null modes that are well known, but rather in these new tools, in this conditioning number and in the pseudospectra. And we see that, well, if we go higher in the overtones, these conditioning numbers grows a lot. And also the pseudospectra here shows a structure that we don't really see these circles around. We see all this green region here. So this green, take for instance, this line here. This is a line with an pseudospectra epsilon, take the minus 40. So meaning that, well, if I perturb this operator with 10 to the minus 40, anything can happen with the eigenvalues inside this region. They can migrate to anywhere in this region. They may not remain inside the neighborhood. So what we are seeing here, that from the operator itself, there are that, well, conditioning number and the pseudospectra is indicating that, well, there are potential instabilities if I were to perturb this operator. And so to try to trigger these instabilities, with some physical motivation, we are going to change this, the potential, as I said, the Ridge-Wheeler potential, by adding some ad hoc modification. I mean, there is no really derivation from the theory from this, but what we are adding is a potential with oscillates. So essentially, we want to explore how high frequency, I mean, high wave number or low frequency, low wave number would change. So this kind of try to capture small scale and large scale perturbation to the system. And we see that, well, I'm going to show this in a bigger picture. You see how the spectra can change a lot with this. So even if I start with 10 to the minus 8, which is a very, very small, well, here's the one that is stable. So this is a very small perturbation, 10 to the minus 8, and very low frequency, k equals 1. Those are the blue squares. So the QNMs, they stay on the top of the original one. So you see, well, a small change leads to a very, I mean, imperceptible. I mean, we cannot see this by eye here. But as long as I start to increase the frequency, k equals 20, or even k equals 60, but keep the amplitude low, 10 to the minus 8. So this is a very tiny perturbation, but high frequency. You see how the QNMs change a lot. They start to open up around here. And oh, well, I mean, I can also keep k equals 20 and increase the amplitude. And you see how we can change a lot the QNM just by a small perturbation on the spectrum. So some further partial conclusions is that, well, I forgot to tell. Let me come back here. Sorry. We are changing all the overtones, but you see that no matter what we are doing, the fundamental mode, the one with the slowest decay, is not changing. So the fundamental mode here seems to be pretty much stable, but the overtones are undergoing such instabilities. So conclusions, the fundamental mode seems to be stable if the potential perturbation respects the asymptotic decay. So this has to do with the hyperboloidal slice. And if you cut at some point, you may change even the fundamental one. And the overtone seems to be stable under low frequency perturbations, but they are showing instabilities under high frequency perturbations. And of course, I mean, this result
Sorry
is
to
not really.
interrupt you. We ended the 15 minutes.
Okay, sorry.
Could
I'll
you
conclude
please, yeah, wrap up?
just to give credit to Noller and Price, who saw these instabilities back in the 90s. So these branches here, they are showing the pseudo spectra. So thank you so much. I'll leave the conclusions there, and sorry for going over. Thanks.